Good afternoon and welcome to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. In this hour, how Google affects our knowledge, our politics, our privacy, and our public projects, and why we should be concerned. Then, worse than war, we'll explore eliminationism and genocide in the 20th and 21st century. Then, on the Scholar's Circle, observers from both the left and the right have been critical of President Obama's leadership and policies. How much should citizens expect from their president? How much power does a president really have to shape public policy? And how should we assess President Obama's performance? What are the consequences of this enormous preponderance of Google? Our next guest says that it affects the information we can obtain, retains our personal data, and prevents great public projects from moving forward. Should we be concerned about the Googleization of everything? Siva Vaidyanathan joins us. He is professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia and the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Welcome to The Insiders, Siva Vaidyanathan.
Thank you very much.
You say that now we see the world through a lens of Google, and it's changing the way we think. How so?
Think about all the different ways, the extent to which we depend on Google. In a very short period of time, 10 years, without really thinking about what we're doing, we've outsourced so much judgment, decision-making, to this one company. And fortunately for us and for the company, it's done a pretty good job of guiding us through these questions. There are certain biases built into Google search systems. Google is increasingly focusing its search results to reflect what you have already told Google you're interested in. So your field of vision is getting narrower and narrower. Google is helping to reinforce what you already know, already think, already like. This is really good for shopping, but it's not really good for learning. In an ideal learning environment, you're challenged, you're surprised, you're thrown for a loop. As Google continues to give you what you already feel satisfied by, say you are researching a major political issue, Google has some sense of the places you've tended to go on your own, your habits, and is going to want to reinforce those habits with the same sources you've gone to or sources very clearly like it. You're almost certainly going to get results that reinforce what you already think. And nothing makes you feel better than to think you know what's going on and then find four or five good-looking websites that echo back to you what you think is true. But that's not necessarily the best way to research health information or big scientific information or public policy. In those situations, we actually do want to get a sense of the complexity, a sense of the back and forth about the flaws in certain arguments and the weaknesses in certain claims. For that reason, I think it's really important that we understand and just decide that it's not a magical force that will guide us to the right answers or will settle anything more complex than a bar bet. If you really want to explore something complex, interesting, human, it's much better to talk to an information professional, a librarian, talk to experts in the field, use multiple search sources as the beginning of your search, and don't be satisfied with any of the answers.
You actually compared it to Julius Caesar's rule in Rome. How do they really compare?
Let's not pretend that Google is a brutal dictator in any way. What I was trying to make the point about is that there was a time not so long ago when the web was deemed unrulable and ungovernable. It seemed too crazy and lawless, and there didn't seem to be a way to get control of it, and Google figured out how to step into that vacuum with the applause and acclamation of us, millions, billions of web users. And to a large degree, Google determines the shape and feel of the web. It rules the web with soft power, but it rules the web nonetheless. So it's a benevolent dictator. It's an unelected dictator, but it's a dictator nonetheless.
Now, you've said that it ensures that our web experience is calmer, friendlier, less controversial, and less frightening.
Yeah. For one thing, think back 10 years ago. If you were just pecking around the web looking for innocent information, the chances of stumbling upon pornography were very high. You would never put a four-year-old child on your lap as you did web searches. There were huge trust issues. And without really noticing it, we've all become so comfortable. And I think we actually have Google to thank for this. Google does not actually operate as a flat plane of glass. It makes editorial decisions about what is important and what is not. And one of the ways it does that is it judges certain aspects of web page design to be appropriate and significant and worthy of ranking higher, and takes other factors and ranks them lower. And it just so happens that these factors track with which pages are not pornography and which pages are pornography. So without censoring any pornography, Google has managed to downgrade the scores of pornographic pages, thus making them less likely to stumble upon.
Another issue back on the political matter is there is a little bit of a censorship issue, not just that it chooses things that you already like, but also you gave an example in your book about on YouTube, once it took over YouTube, there was an issue with the New Mexico politician, Heather Wilson. Tell us what happened.
One of the problems is that anytime someone's making political commentary using clips of news programs, you're essentially engaging in what's known in the copyright law as fair use. You're taking someone's copyrighted work, but because it's public interest material and news material, it has a very low threshold of protection under copyright. If you use that material in a new way that helps enhance political discussion or debate, then you should not be subject to any sort of punishment. Unfortunately, with YouTube, Google has to obey a rather clumsy part of the copyright law, where if a copyright holder demands that you take something down, it goes down right away. So in the Wilson case, someone had made a critical video for YouTube, a clip of her husband, and it was quickly taken down on a copyright claim. And that's the sort of thing that can mess up political discourse. It's really hard to get that put back up. That's just one of the many ways that Google essentially protects itself. The very fact that you can use copyright as an instrument of censorship is kind of disturbing.
And you also mentioned, and it also intervened, when an anti-Semitic site turned up higher than the Wikipedia listing.
At times, Google's been accused of not doing enough to downgrade hate speech. And anti-Semitic speech has been the most noticed of this. And over the years, Google officials have been very clear that it's not people at Google making these decisions, it's the algorithms that are reading the web. And the fact is, the web's full of nasty stuff and stuff written by nasty people, and there's not much you can do about that. So it's been in Google's interest to get everyone to believe that Google is not making editorial decisions. But the fact is, Google is. It's just making it at a distance. It's not making direct editorial decisions, not saying this page and not this page, but it's building values into its algorithm that certainly favor or disfavor certain pages. And there are places in the world, like Germany, for instance, where anti-Semitic sites don't show up in Google searches. So Google is making those decisions in other parts of the world, just not in the United States. But I do think that Google should be straightforward about the extent to which it does favor and disfavor certain materials. And right now, Google's not been straightforward about that.
How does it decide? Is it really strict algorithm based on preferences of the user, or is it popularity, or is it some combination of both?
Oh, it's a combination of those two things and thousands of other factors, and we're not allowed to know the ingredients in the soup. We know some basic things. For years, the major factor was the number of incoming links to a particular page. So if you're doing a search for something like Boston Red Sox, Google would go and examine every page that has that phrase, Boston Red Sox. And each page would get a score, and that score would be a result of the number of other pages pointing to those pages. So the most popular page would be ranked highest. And that was the core of Google's search algorithm for years, and it still is a major part. On top of that, Google tries to look for some other signals, like page design choices, how slick and smooth certain pages are, how cluttered or clean, and Google prefers clean over cluttered. And then, of course, Google, with this personalization move over the last 2 years, is increasingly dictating your search results based on what you've already told it. So you and I are very likely to get a different set of search results for the same search done at the same time by virtue of having interacted with Google in different ways over the years and by virtue of being in different places. Because I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia, so my searches are going to be affected by what other people in Charlottesville search for.
Google copies everything, blogs, photos, material. How is this company using it to their advantage but to our disadvantage?
Everything is rigged for Google's advantage. In one sense, Google copies everything that's on the web, but in another sense, Google also makes a record of all of our activity, all of our clicks, all of the times that we hover over a link and don't click. Google has a tremendous amount of information about what we like and what we don't like. And Google uses this information for two purposes. One is, from their point of view, to improve search. From my point of view, it just improves shopping. The other way that Google uses it is to target advertisement to us. Over time, Google's going to be able to do enough statistical analysis to be able to pretty accurately figure out our politics, what kind of cars we like. Now, the good news is Google does not sell that information to any third-party companies further exploring. Yeah, it doesn't do it yet. And under the current regime, I'm not convinced Google needs to. Google's making a tremendous amount of money. When things go badly, as they do for every company, at that point, Google could do some really nasty things and sell a lot of this information to the highest bidder. In addition, all this information is susceptible to phishing expeditions by federal investigators, and that could sweep innocent people up into dragnets, and that could be bad news.
Let's talk for a moment about Google's effect on journalism and what they are doing now with major news organizations.
There are some news organizations that have been very nasty about Google. Rupert Murdoch himself, who runs News Corporation, which of course owns Fox News and the Boston Herald and a number of other publications and stations around the world, has accused Google of essentially free riding on other people's work. And I don't think that's a fair characterization of what Google does. In many ways, what Google does with most websites, and that means most journalism websites, is it gives a lot of people exposure. It drives traffic to the websites that know how to play the game. That is part of the problem. Some websites like Huffington Post really know how to play the game. The game is search engine optimization. The game is understanding what Google loves and giving Google what it loves. And so when you do a web search about a news issue, you're very likely to come across a Huffington Post version of that story and not a New York Times version of that story. And that is because Huffington Post knows the game and the other news organizations don't really. That's not necessarily good for journalism. Google has been trying to correct for that a little bit. In recent months, it's been trying to adjust its algorithms to favor what it considers to be high-quality sources, like the New York Times. This, of course, opens up all sorts of questions. Well, who are you to decide what's high quality?
There's so much more to talk about with regards to Google, especially the future of books, the copyright issues. But I think perhaps we should end with this issue, this idea that what's really happening is that Google is preventing us from launching a truly great human knowledge project.
Yeah, Google's crowding out a lot of interesting experimentation. Anytime that Google announces it's going into a particular area, makes it really hard for public institutions, for foundations, and even for venture capitalists to justify investing in it, because who can compete with Google? And so when Google decided to go into the library scanning business to try to open up a lot of stuff to readers, it scared a lot of people in the library community away from thinking big about creating a digital global library, a digital national library. Fortunately, a bunch of people have decided that they're not going to let Google scare them. And so, led by some folks at Harvard University, there is now a project for a Digital Public Library of America that would take a long-term view of the idea of linking Americans to the information that they own and they bought. They're not letting Google's presence scare them in the least.
You're saying that they have established this process and this way of thinking that's actually hindering us from developing something that's truly beneficial to the public.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. Google is such a big presence that it really crowds out a lot of imagination and a lot of interesting activity. So I really hope that as Google enters its adolescence, now it's about to turn 13 years old, that we step back and we realize that Google's just a company. It's a brilliant company, but it's still just a company. And we really need to demystify it as soon as possible.
And what are the alternatives to Google?
There are human beings. There are libraries. There are librarians. There are experts. And then there are a dozen or so search engines. The idea is to entertain diversity in search and understand that Google isn't the answer to everything. If you're doing searches for health information, you would want to go to demonstrable experts in the field, not mess with Google and not WebMD, both of which are suspect. And on complicated subjects, you really do want to talk to librarians first. Make sure you're using vetted information, not just something that some guy put up on a blog.
Thank you so much, Siva Vaidyanathan.
My pleasure.
Stay tuned. Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. While the 20th century has been called the mass murder century by scholars, Our next guest says hundreds of millions of people are still at risk of becoming victims of genocide and other mass killings. Why do mass killings continue, and how can the cycle be brought to an end? That is the subject of a book called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. The author, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, joins us now. Welcome, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, I think I'd like to start with the spectrum that you look at. Eliminationism, you call it. You have genocide on one end, but you incorporate all kinds of levels of really mass killings in various ways, and also just trying to move populations out. Why don't you talk about this spectrum?
Well, when people typically talk about genocide, they sequester it off from everything else we know about politics and social action. These are treated as volcanic eruptions, uncontrollable ethnic conflicts that bend further out of control. And in fact, the underlying phenomenon is much more familiar. And because it's more familiar, in fact, when you understand it, we can actually do much more about it. And genocide is but the expression of a certain kind of politics, which can be called eliminationism, which is what it sounds like, which is when leaders decide that they want to eliminate groups of people whom they see as a threat or they see as being an impediment to their political goals, whatever they are. And when they decide upon eliminationist policy, they use a variety of policy tools, of implements, in order to eliminate them. They force them to transform themselves, such as force them to convert to another religion. They systematically deny them the right, the ability to reproduce themselves, and this is done through mass rape and other means. They incarcerate them in concentration camps. They expel them. And they kill them, and the largest such killings we call genocide. And so one of the things I argue in the book, Worse Than War, is that we need to recognize this politics and fight all kinds of eliminationism. And it's particularly the case that genocide should be seen as a form of eliminationism when one realizes that in every instance of what we call genocide, the perpetrators have been doing some of these other things that I've mentioned, expelling victims, incarcerating them, preventing the reproduction, and so on. And so this is the underlying phenomenon. It's not been recognized as such, and it's not treated as such. It's not treated as what it is in the international political community and international security discussions. And so one of the things I want to do is to try to shift the discussion and bring this horrible and very widespread form of politics into focus.
Now, you looked over history, and you said the phenomenon is really quite ancient. How far back does it go?
It goes as far back as we know. In the ancient world, slaughtering groups which one conquered was a very normal thing. Slaughtering the men, many of them, all of them, enslaving the others. Slavery, when used, is a form of eliminationism as well. And it's been with us through human history. In the book and the film, I focus on the genocides and eliminations during our time because there's some particular characteristics of what has happened in our world. And most of all, I'm interested in the end in policy, that is, in trying to put an end to the killing.
So let's start then with the 20th century, because, of course, this week is the 85th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and that is what a lot of scholars called the first genocide of the 20th century. Perhaps you can start with that and put it into this context of your book.
But it's actually not the first genocide of the 20th century. There was a holdover genocide from the 19th century by the Belgians in the Congo, and nobody knows actually how many millions of people they killed there. And the Germans in Southwest Africa in 1904 set out to exterminate the entire Herero people and killed three-quarters of them. And so the Armenian genocide is, of course, deserving of our attention and was horrific beyond horrific, but it is not the first. In 1915, the Turkish government decided to solve its so-called Armenian problem, which they understood to be a threat to the integrity of Turkey because the Armenians were not very eager to be part of Turkey. And so they set out under the cover of war to rid the country of Armenians by killing a huge number, expelling others, and they ended up killing approximately 1.5 million Armenians. As in all other genocides, the killing was not done in a clinical way. It was done utterly brutally. They often tortured their victims. And as in all other genocides, or the perpetrators believed that what they were doing was right. They believed the Armenians, who were Christian, not Muslim, as most Turks were, who were ethnically different, who were an alien people as they understood them, needed to be destroyed or eradicated or eliminated in order for Turkey to prosper. And so you find in genocide after genocide, the Turks of the Armenians, the Holocaust, Guatemala, Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, Darfur. The perpetrators are eager, willing. They do much more to their victims than they have to. In other words, they perpetrate cruelties upon them, which are totally unnecessary, even for the act of killing. We need to recognize this and recognize that these are not abstractions that are doing this. These are human beings who are making decisions to raise their hand and strike their victims down.
I thought it was really compelling, one of the breakdowns that you did, looking specifically at the Rwandan genocide. A Tutsi survivor had said to you that 20% killed reluctantly, 40% enthusiastically, 10% helped, and 30% were forced to kill. Now, do you think that's accurate?
We don't know what the exact percentages are, but it captures the sense of what happened in Rwanda. And we should remember that when we're talking about killing in Rwanda, as in some other genocides or mass eliminations, we're talking about neighbors killing neighbors. And we should always keep in mind also they're not killing military-aged men as they would in a military conflict. They're killing them, of course, but they're also killing women, and they're slaughtering children, often in the cruelest of ways. And we have much testimony from perpetrators and victims alike about the enthusiasm of the killers, about their cruelty, about their zeal. And in fact, in the book and in the film, I've interviewed perpetrators. It is just absolutely stunning to hear them talk about how they view the victims, what they did. And one of the perpetrators in Rwanda says quite clearly that his fellow killers, like himself, and they were killing people living in their commune. His fellow killers and himself, and he says, I include myself among them, did not believe that the Tutsi, that is the people they were killing, were human beings. And he said, if we had believed it, we wouldn't have done it.
One of the things that I think is potentially unique in some of these situations, and Rwanda is one of them, is that the Rwandans, the Hutus and the Tutsis, had lived together for a very long time and really didn't distinguish between each other until the Belgians had come and occupied it and started to separate them out and distinguish them. But even after that, same religion, same language, essentially same people, and there wasn't that much animosity until the radio, RTLM, started broadcasting these messages. How big of a role does the propaganda and the media play in your estimation?
Well, it varies from mass elimination to mass elimination. I would give, and I do give, a slightly different history of Rwanda than you have put forward. It is true the Belgians fomented enmity between the two peoples as a divide-and-conquer strategy for their colonial rule. But it's not as if once the Belgians left in 1960 that this came to an end. There's an enormous amount of testimony that discrimination continued against the Tutsi in Rwanda, that in Hutu circles all kinds of prejudices were common and in fact were mother's milk, and they took the notion that Tutsis are snakes, as they called them, or cockroaches, devils in human form, as being just the way the world was. Now, they didn't kill them, and though there were many, you know, there were several mass killings before the great slaughter in which Hutu killed 800,000 Tutsi in 1994. The way we should look at it instead is that in many societies, including Rwanda, long-standing prejudice and hatreds which simmer beneath the surface because the political authorities don't allow them to be expressed in violence can easily be turned on. When they said it's time to kill, the Hutu understood immediately what they were talking about, why they would do it, and they went out and slaughtered their neighbors. And, of course, the messages they were getting that they were being threatened by the Tutsi over the radio that you mentioned and in other ways inflamed them and urged them onward. But if they hadn't believed what they already believed about Tutsi, they would have never done it. As Elie Nigarambe, the perpetrator I mentioned, testify when he said, if they had been, we thought they're human beings, we wouldn't have done it.
Now, do you think that that is also the case in, say, the Armenian genocide and other ones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the case in most. The great exception to that are the communist mass slaughters, where regimes come into power and have to inculcate a new set of views into the young of the country. But in most mass slaughters, that is not the case. That prejudices that exist in society are quickly activated when political leaders make the decision. But this is the critical point for policy, that genocides don't happen, mass eliminations don't happen just because there's great prejudice. You need the prejudice because you need a group of willing perpetrators, but you need the political leadership to enact a program of systematic mass killing or elimination. that doesn't happen, you don't have a genocide. And in instance after instance, the decision to initiate the mass killing and elimination has been made by one man or a small group of men and at a discrete time, and they did so because they thought they would get away with it and it would bring them much more benefit than cost. Once you recognize this, you realize that we can change that decision-making moment. We can change their decision-making calculus, make it clear to them the cost of slaughtering and eliminating people will be far greater than the benefits brought to them. And in doing so, we can stay the hand of future would-be genocidal and eliminationist leaders. The state is critical. And this is very different from how people talk about genocide, which is like some kind of volcanic eruption. It's not. It's politics. It's eliminationist politics. It's planned. Start looking at it that way and responding to politics with the tools that we know that work, which is other kinds of politics.
For example?
For example, we have to first of all create an international system that is not permissive, which it is now. The international system says that as long as you don't attack people in another country, legally there's not much anybody can do if you slaughter people in your own country or expel them or put them in camps. The UN and the notion of sovereignty protects states acting within their own borders. We need to change that. We need to stop protecting the dictatorships of the world, which are the proto-genocidal states of the world. In the world today, dictatorships are all potential genocidal states because the violence they use to maintain their power, that is the dictators, the authoritarian rulers, and those who support them, the violence that they use on a regular basis to maintain their power is never that far from being raised to eliminationist levels. If the challenge becomes to their rule becomes that much greater, or if the leaders decide it's finally time to preemptively get rid of that challenge. And so we have to delegitimize these states, stop supporting them, and give them all kinds of incentives, the elites of these countries, to install democratic institutions.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment, because, you know, one of the interesting things is that the United States, and you even open your book with the United States and Harry Truman and his mm-hmm. mass killing of Japanese civilians by dropping bombs, and how that, you know, so many people made excuses for it. And then you also talk about the killings in Central America, which were largely funded by the United States. United States is a democratic republic, mm-hmm. and it's not a dictatorship. And it has perpetrated huge numbers of mass killings.
The United States has not bathed itself in glory. We can put it in a much more word. The United States has itself, as you pointed out, it has perpetrated mass slaughters in the past. We can start with Native Americans and move forward. A lot of that was done in the context of the Cold War, when the East-West conflict trumped all moral and considerations. And I think that the United States and other Western countries have learned a great deal, particularly in the last 10 years, about what is right and appropriate and acceptable conduct in international affairs.
I'm really struggling with this only because I'm thinking about the Bush administration and going into Iraq.
Yeah, but what everyone thinks of the war in Iraq, it's not an eliminationist or genocidal undertaking.
But we
need to make distinctions between yeah. war and the out-and-out slaughter of unarmed men, women, and children, which is what takes place during genocide.
The end result of the war in Iraq did end up with massive killings, whether it was eliminationist or not. So the only thing I'm questioning now is your...
Okay. But you see, here's the issue. The international realm is an anarchic realm. So you need to have agents to act well as opposed to acting badly. If you have other agents that you think would be better to stop slaughters in Rwanda, I'm happy to hear who they are. I mean, we have to deal with reality. You know, the problem with tempering the bloodlust is that we have very little ability to affect internally in the different countries what goes on. You need to stop the leadership of the would-be genocidal leaders with negative incentives and positive incentives. I mean, you want to try to do this as peacefully as possible. And if I'm happy to support any agents, international agents, but one has to, who might do this, but the reality is that, as in Bosnia, it was NATO that had the capacity to do it and that actually did it, and it took the use of force. And the question people have to ask themselves, who might look askance at the United States or other Western countries using force, is do they think that the Western forces, the UN, the Belgian forces under the auspices of the UN, should have pulled out in April 1994 in Rwanda and let the people be slaughtered, which is what actually happened. Or should they have? Should we have inserted more troops there, which we could have, and saved the people? Survivors of genocide say all the time when you go to talk to them, why didn't your country do anything to save us?
Right. And it does beg the question about when to intervene and when not to. And yet, at the same time, I guess the only concern that I have about the argument, when should the U.S. intervene, well, when shouldn't it intervene? But at the same time, of course, under the auspices of what you said, the, you know, battling the Red War, the U.S. set up dictatorships throughout Latin America, Chile being the perfect example.
Well, I don't want to pretend that that democratic countries are angels internationally. Far from it. They have all kinds of self-interest, which don't serve developing countries very well at all. But with regard to killing people, neither the people nor the governments of the advanced industrial democracies, the democratic ones, have any desire to see people being slaughtered elsewhere in the world. And so, yes, I agree with the historical account in my book itself, but I think times have changed, and let's hope that I'm right about this.
Let's hope.
And with regard to intervention, the thing to do is we have to create a prevention system. You don't want to intervene, because once the killing begins, it's too late. Perpetrators can kill 10,000 people in a day, and we have to realize it's 10,000 people, their children being slaughtered, and lives ruined, communities destroyed. And so we want a prevention system so that the would-be genocidal leaders will say, it's not even worth going there. I have to deal with my political problems in other ways. And so that's what we have to think about. There's not even a discussion in the international political community within the UN and elsewhere of what a serious prevention system would look like. And if you can prevent one genocide, you will do more to save lives than if we cut the murder rate, you know, in half in Los Angeles in a year, which would everybody would say would be a great accomplishment. I would applaud it, but it would be a drop in the bucket compared to the number of lives we would save if we prevent one genocide.
That's a perfect place to end this. Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, I'd like to say thank you very, very much. Very interesting discussion here. And the film and the book are both called Worse Than War, mm-hmm. Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, blame Obama or blame the system? We'll look at presidential powers and constraints. Stay tuned.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up.
Welcome to the Scholars Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. Observers from both the left and the right have been deeply critical of President Obama's leadership and policies. What is the likelihood of success with a divided Congress? Given the system and the constraints on presidential powers, how might we assess the president? And how much power does a president really have to shape public policy? We have three experts with us. We have Princeton historian Julian Zelizer. He is the author of numerous books, including Arsenal of Democracy, Conservatives in Power, Taxing America, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter. Welcome back, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
UC Berkeley political science professor Eric Schickler also joins us. He is the author of numerous books, including award-winning Disjointed Pluralism, Institutional Innovation in the Development of the U.S. Congress, Partisan Hearts and Minds, and Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the U.S. Senate. Welcome, Eric Schickler.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And historian Alan Lichtman is a professor at American University in Washington, D.C. His books include Prejudice in the Old Politics, The Keys to the White House, and his latest, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of American Conservative Movement. In addition to his scholarly pursuits, Alan Lichtman was an expert for the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Welcome, Alan Lichtman.
My great pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the historians to put this presidency into a historical context. Do you think we have seen enough from President Obama to compare him to other presidents and other periods? Julian Zelizer, why don't you start?
Well, sure. You can always find parts of an existing president that relate to what we've seen. It's usually a mix of different presidents rather than being exactly like someone else. So with President Obama, we saw a little of LBJ, meaning the ability to push through a rather significant legislative agenda during the first 2 years, including the stimulus, health care, and more. We see a little of Jimmy Carter, including some of the difficulties of communication and conveying an effective message to the public and some of the difficulties politically with members of his own party. And finally, we see a little of President Clinton, a Democrat trying to govern in a conservative age of politics with limited resources and a quite vibrant and politically strong conservative movement.
Alan Lichtman?
Well, just to show historians can find comparisons everywhere, let me turn to two very different presidents. Let me first compare them to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt came into the presidency at the end of a solidly conservative era of American politics, the 1920s. Likewise, Barack Obama came into office at the end of a pretty solidly conservative era that really started in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan. And each had an opportunity to transform the politics of the country and move the country in a solidly liberal direction. Certainly Franklin Roosevelt succeeded in doing that. In fact, the many decades after that are sometimes called the Roosevelt era. Barack Obama has had much more difficulty in making that transformation. In some ways, his difficulties are a bit more like that of Ronald Reagan, a conservative who came in at the end of a liberal era and was trying to push the government in a conservative direction. He also had to deal with divided government, and he was also very heavily criticized by his own base for not being conservative enough and not moving the nation far enough in a conservative direction, just as you hear criticism from his base, this time the left, of Barack Obama, that despite the extraordinary health care plan, something that had defied liberals for decades, despite the financial regulation, despite the stimulus package, he's not moved far enough to the left. Of course, there remains to be seen how much of a transformational president he will be.
Eric Schickler.
I think all of those analogies capture an important element of what's going on. I guess to me the striking comparison and the maybe the worrisome one is that one way to think about it is we've had the last three presidents who were Democrats who came in with unified party government, Carter, Clinton, and Obama. The first 2 years, they vary a lot in the policy success. I would say Obama clearly had much more policy success than the first two in the first 2 years. But all three of them had tremendous kind of political problems working together with their own party in Congress. And you could argue that all three were really political failures in those first 2 years. And with Clinton, it was only when you got divided party control, and ironically, you couldn't get as much done legislatively, that he started his political recovery. And in some ways, it seems like something similar is playing out with Obama. I think is, you know, just given the kind of high hopes that people came in when Obama started, it's a cause for concern about just the future of, you know, can you get a Democratic president and Democratic Congress to not only create legislation, but actually have a kind of political success as well.
And when you're saying political success, you mean?
I mean, not have a situation where the party basically looks like a mess for 2 years, fighting amongst themselves and allowing Republicans to really stake out a clear oppositional stance, where you're being attacked from the right or the center of the party as doing too much, from the left as doing too little, and then, you know, trying to put together a coalition where the public looks at it and they see Republicans unified in opposition, Democrats really failing to act as a team together, and the public looks at that and concludes that there's something wrong with the policies themselves. I don't think it's necessarily the right conclusion for the public to reach, but it seems like that's what happened in 1994. To some extent, that's what happened in 2010. To me, looking back at least at recent history, it's that kind of echo that's striking about the first 2 years of Obama.
One thing that seems quite different in my observation is that we are dealing with a very polarized media today. that was certainly not so rabid, it seems, during any of the previous presidents that we mentioned, other than President Clinton, which is where I believe it began to start sounding as rabid as it does in certain frequencies. What role do you think that plays? Eric Schickler, why don't you start?
It certainly provides a microphone for Republicans in putting out a kind of common view and lines of attack against Obama that then start out in conservative media and then permeate out from there. The polarization in the media in some ways just reflects also a polarization in politics where Republicans today are much more unified as a kind of group than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Democrats are also more unified than they were 40 years ago, but not nearly as much as Republicans. And so just politics as a whole, with the media as a part of that, takes on the element of these two warring armies going at it. And that obviously makes it much harder to have constructive debate, deliberation, you know, so that when you're trying to work on a complex policy like, say, healthcare reform, very quickly degenerates into the kind of lowest common denominator discussion.
Julian Zelizer, anything on that?
Yeah, I think it is significant, the changes we saw first with the advent of cable television and its expansion in the 1980s, and then with the internet. I think it does several things. One is it provides a bully pulpit of sorts for the opposition. So presidents always had the capacity to really shape and dominate national debate in a way that I think is becoming more difficult in this period. It's also fragmented the media market, so it's more difficult for the president to convey and articulate and reach a national audience. Years ago, if the president delivered his State of the Union address and you wanted to watch TV, that's what you had to watch. Today, it's easy to ignore it. So it creates added burdens for the president to respond to critics. I think, like Eric said, it both reflects and fuels the polarization in politics. And finally, it gives the opportunity for organizations and rallies that once might have just been local events to become national. So if you think of the early 1960s, there were many right-wing groups that were emerging and protesting John F. Kennedy and the Democratic agenda, but a lot of what they were doing was off the radar if you were living in a different part of the country. Today, because of the media, I think it can amplify those events. So all this, I think, provides new challenges to all political leaders, and it further fuels the polarization in our system.
Alan Lick, was that a disagreement with the assessment?
No, but I would qualify it by saying, look at the sweep of history. This is not unique. Rabid is as American as apple pie. The opposition media called Thomas Jefferson an atheist and a murderer. They called Andrew Jackson a murderer. They called Lincoln a dictator and a quote-unquote N-lover. And anything negative you can imagine was said against Franklin Roosevelt, including that he was a clone of Hitler and Stalin at the same time. So we shouldn't overemphasize the uniqueness of a rabid opposition media. What I do think is different today is something Eric pointed out, and that is the polarization of the parties. You used to have within the Republican Party a lot of the so-called Rockefeller-type liberal Republicans. Today you can name about two of them, and they're both from the same state. Susan Collins and Olympia Snow, all inspector. Lincoln Chafee, the others are all gone, which has made for a much more conservative Republican Party. At the same time, you used to have a lot of moderate to conservative Southern Democrats, and they're almost all gone. There's a few left, but most of them have been replaced either by very conservative Republicans, or in some cases in the U.S. House, by very liberal Latino and African-American Democrats. And the result is today, the most liberal Republican is still more conservative than the most conservative Democrats. You don't have this intermingling of liberals and conservatives in the two parties, which makes it very difficult for the parties to work together and contributes to the contentiousness of our politics. We have a unique situation today where our politicians are far more polarized than the American people.
But I also want to bring in some of these other constraints that fall upon presidents. You hear people on the progressive side of the spectrum complaining that Obama has capitulated to Wall Street. Others argue that if he doesn't capitulate to Wall Street, the entire economy will collapse. Let's talk about this as one possible constraint, and let's talk about the others as well, including Congress and the bureaucracy. Eric Schickler, why don't you start?
I think that entering office in the midst of a financial crisis, as Obama did, puts you in this kind of peculiar relationship with Wall Street, where on the one hand, it seems pretty clear that excesses, lack of regulation and so on Wall Street is what caused the problem in the first place. Question is, you know, what's the best way to get out of it? And I think he very early on, I mean, really before he even entered office, decided that to get out of it is going to require at least a kind of reasonable relationship with some of the people who caused the problems. And I think that's probably a calculation that just about any American president is going to make. It's certainly what their advisors are telling them. It does then kind of limit the range of things that you're going to propose. But I'd say, on the other hand, that if you did try to do something, you know, that is more confrontational with Wall Street, you'd have two problems. One is your dependence on them to finance investment and so on, so that adversarial relationship, if it deepens or lengthens the recession, is going to hurt you. And then secondly is, you know, is there really going to be an appetite in Congress to pass the kinds of extremely tough regulatory changes that kind of confrontation would call for? And I think you can see both of those as constraints that would make that a less attractive option.
Alan Lichtman?
Yeah, I would agree with all of that, but I would add something very important. I was no particular fan of the Ralph Nader presidential campaigns, but I think he made a very good point in which he says the ways in which both parties have now become dependent on special interest money. Money is just overwhelming our political system, and it's just got a lot worse after the Supreme Court decision, which I think, you know, kind of jiggered the Constitution to define corporations as persons with all the rights of persons to contribute to political campaigns. The amount of spending in the last presidential campaign, get this, was about 10 times more than when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. That's not ancient history. It costs millions of dollars today just to win a congressional seat, tens of millions of dollars to win a senatorial seat. Now, of course, some of this money you can get from small donors, and Obama was very good at that, but the amount of special interest money in politics is just overwhelming, and it makes it very difficult for any kind of fundamental progressive change. And look, too, at the Tea Party. These folks are saying we're outside of politics, you know, we're something new, we're an important new force in politics, and as soon as they get to Washington, who are they cozying up to? The same old corporate lobbyists and the same old corporate donors. And now the Tea Party types even talking about eliminating the small amount of public funding we have for presidential campaigns. Until we loosen the grip of money on our politics, which is not easy, it may require a constitutional amendment, it may require huge public financing, which does not seem to be in prospect, dependence on Wall Street, the big oil companies, and other special interests is not going to change.
Julian Zelizer, I know you've also written about campaign finance. Do you agree with this assessment? And also, you've written about other constraints, including the bureaucracy and the military. Why don't you bring those constraints in?
At least on the financial policy, it's clearly a mix of constraint and strategy. The constraints are everything that have been mentioned, from the power of campaign finance and private money, which strengthens the very interests that have to be reformed, to the political realities that Eric outlined, where Democrats have had a lot of political trouble, even if they're experiencing some policy success. So even in a crisis as severe as the one we were in, I think the political realities were quite stark for Obama. There was also a strategic decision. It's unclear at this point, at least to me, whether Obama wanted to do that much more. He surrounded himself with advisors from the Clinton era, and I'm not sure that was all some kind of either cover or, you know, political strategy. I think he in some ways comes out of that Clinton era of Democratic politics, and these are the advisors he trusts and believes in, the kind of Larry Summers cohort that worked in that era. Finally, on all sets of policies, yes, presidents don't remake politics. When you study the presidency, what you instantly learn is the frustration that most of the winners face when they come to Washington and they learn that Capitol Hill looks a lot more powerful when you're sitting in the White House than it does on the campaign trail. A lot of policies, whether you're talking about the military or Social Security, are very hard to change. Various interests get accustomed to them, and they're not going to allow them to go away. And bureaucracies also develop a strength and a certain momentum of their own. So presidents come in, whether in crisis or in normal times, And this is the kind of environment they face. It's rare for presidents to totally remake American politics. It happens, but it's rare.
Julian Zelizer, I'd like to expand on one thing, and this is because of your last book on the arsenal of democracy, where you recounted the building of this military and bureaucracies that go with it. How much do you think this gigantic military and bureaucracy and all of the intelligence agencies really are overpowering decisions? So, for example, Obama said when he came into office that he wanted to close Guantanamo Bay and end the wars, although he did say he was going to add troops into Afghanistan, which he did. How much do you think that these agencies are influencing his change of mind and how he's approaching these wars?
I mean, I think actually partisanship is as powerful a force as the so-called military-industrial complex. And with Guantanamo as a case in point, the pullback wasn't because military officials were in a quiet room telling him, you can't do this, Mr. President. Part of it was the response that a lot of Democrats faced as soon as he announced this and the ability of Republicans to really play up the issue. So partisan politics often makes it difficult for presidents, particularly Democratic presidents, to really revise many of the existing national security policies. So it has an effect. Partisanship also has an effect. And I think strategy has not been the only reason that a lot of the national security programs from the Bush era remain in place.
Eric Schickler, I know you study lawmaking. You focus a lot on Congress. You know, we're going into this divided Congress. Many people on the left said, why isn't President Obama behaving more like FDR? Now, in today's climate, is anything like that even possible?
I think that FDR, while an attractive kind of model, is just not a realistic kind of option for Obama. And I think there are a couple of differences. One is, you know, FDR came into office after the stock market crash had happened 3.5 years before. Unemployment had already hit 23% before he entered office. And so that in that context of kind of desperation that had been lasting so long, he had available to him a kind of more radical attack or critique or stance than Obama did, where in Obama's case, while the Great Recession was getting underway when he entered office, it actually hit bottom under his watch. I mean, due to policies that had been in effect before, but that creates a very different context that limits your maneuvering. And, you know, FDR had giant majorities in Congress really almost throughout his term. It's not till 1938 that Republicans start to make a comeback. And that's just a different world. And so to expect Obama to be able to follow the same kind of strategy of FDR, you know, FDR in 1936, after that election, there are 16 or 17 Senate Republicans. So it's just a different world from what Obama faces today.
Alan Lichtman.
I agree with that entirely. And I would add one thing that I see as another problem with our politics, aside from this enormous influence of money and lobbying, and that is the lack of civic engagement. We really don't have, particularly on the progressive side, to back up Obama, a real grassroots progressive movement. We have something of a grassroots movement on the right in the Tea Party, but we don't have any longer a grassroots political movement on the left. Let's not forget that Roosevelt and Truman and other presidents had the grassroots support of a very robust labor movement that by the 1950s and really the 1940s comprised about a third of the American workforce. Today it's down to about 10% of the American workforce. Let's not forget that we had the great movements of civil rights, environment, and women's rights in the 1960s. That was also all sustained by very vibrant grassroots movements. There was a very vibrant anti-war movement in the 1960s and early 1970s as well. And I thought that perhaps with his new organizing techniques, Obama might be able to accomplish that, but he hasn't to this point. And it can't all be done, as Julian and Eric have pointed out so eloquently, from the top down because of all of these constraints. You need the American people engaged. You need movement from the bottom up, and we're not seeing that, at least certainly not on the progressive side of politics.
Well, Alan Lichtman, you've made it your business to predict presidential wins. You have said that Obama wins again. Why do you say that, and what do you think will come of that?
I said that over a year ago, in fact, and have repeated it in several different articles. The reason is you cited my book, The 13 Keys to the White House, and the 13 keys are the 13 key factors that decide American presidential elections. And in fact, they have little or nothing to do with campaigns. Rather, the keys turn on the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. And my argument was that the performance of the Obama administration was going to be strong enough to get 4 more years, particularly given an improving economy, a lack of any great disasters abroad, no scandals on his watch, major policy changes to present to the American people, pretty much domestic tranquility. These are not the kinds of circumstances under which the American people turn out a sitting president, particularly with the lack of unity and a lack of any kind of charismatic candidate on the side of the opposition. And all of this took into account the fact that his party, the Democrats, were going to lose the midterm elections. Even taking that into account, in my view, he wins.
My next question, I was going to throw it to Eric Schickler because of how you study the policymaking process and Congress in particular. I mean, we're dealing with a party of no, and Obama has put forward that I want to move forward on renewable energy and sees it as a win-win for the economy, for business, and for the environment. Do you see him succeeding even in the face of a party of no?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think that the prospects for something dramatic through legislation like cap and trade is gone, both because of the Republicans and because of internal Democratic divisions. It was a hard issue, even with a Democratic majority, to get those votes from, you know, coal-producing states. Usually when the game is passing policies that are, say, tax credits and incentives, that kind of politics encourage renewable energy indirectly through the tax system. That is a kind of politics that's more likely to succeed, but it runs up against the difficult budgetary situation and a Republican Party that's extremely hostile to it. So I think it's going to be hard to do. I could imagine some movement happening as part of, say, compromises with Republicans where they get some particular tax changes that they want on other fronts in exchange for more support for renewables. But I think a kind of broad, ambitious agenda he was talking about, I think until the Democrats say were to win back the House so that they really can set the agenda there to get things moving to start, it's going to be extremely hard to do.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so very much for being with us. Eric Schickler is with us. He's a political science professor at UC Berkeley and the author of numerous books, Disjointed Pluralism, Partisan Hearts and Mind, and Filibuster. Julian Zelizer is the author of numerous books. He's a historian at Princeton University. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Conservatives in Power, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter. Alan Lichtman is a historian at the American University in Washington, D.C., and his books include Prejudice in the Old Politics, The Keys to the White House, and White Protestant Nation. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.